Gentlemen of the Commonwealth Club of California, it's a distinct privilege for me to present to you today the former Secretary of Labor, Mr. James P. Mitchell, now a director of the Crown Zellerbach Corporation and a member of its executive committee and a vice president in charge of industrial and public relations for that corporation. Mr. Mitchell will speak on the subject in defense of politics. We all know of his long service as a member of the Eisenhower cabinet, where, as you all know, he was Secretary of Labor. Prior to that, he was director of the personnel division of the headquarters of Army Service Forces in 1942 and 45. He was also director of personnel and industrial relations for the R.H. Macy Company of New York. He later served the Federated Department Stores as the vice president in New York in the year 1947. President Eisenhower first appointed Mr. Mitchell as the Assistant Secretary of the Army for Manpower and Reserve Forces. And then in October of 1953, he appointed him Secretary of Labor. Mr. Mitchell was a member of the Joint Army-Navy Personnel Board in 1943 and 45, and of the Personnel Advisory Board of the Hoover Administration in 1948. He had spoken to us before in 1960. And again, gentlemen, it's my distinct privilege to present to you Mr. Mitchell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, distinguished guests, and ladies and gentlemen. There is no more appropriate forum for a speech about politics in California than the Commonwealth Club, considering the influential audience you provide and your traditional policy of hearing both sides of the issues. But in defending politics today, perhaps I should clear up some possible misunderstandings at the outset. In the first place, the California political fraternity in both parties has no cause for alarm. I left my political aspirations behind in a couple of strategic wards in Jersey City. As a matter of fact, I am not yet fully naturalized Californian, much as I may feel like one after 7 months in this wonderful and stimulating state. Secondly, I hope that anything I say today will not be construed in any partisan sense. Oddly enough, it is possible to be objective and impartial about American politics and our political process if you decide to put your mind to it. When you stand off and look at the American system of representative government from any distance, it seems rather remarkable that a country as large and complex as ours can govern itself and periodically renew its political leadership without coming apart at one seam or another. But as you come closer on the American political scene, on the electorate, on the people who hold public office, the rougher edges begin to get. You soon discover, for example, that the machinery of American politics functions with almost monumental imprecision. It is so untidy, in fact, that it repels many types of excellent men who are appalled when they try to come to grips with it. The realities of political life, the lack of precision and neatness, is often a shocking discovery to the man of business and industry suddenly projected into the political limelight. And this is, I think, a source of continuing difficulty and misunderstanding between the American business community and those in public life. In the face of the growing role of government at all levels in the United States, despite the constant impact of government actions and policies on our personal welfare, a wide gulf between the electorate and the officeholder persists. It can be argued, I know, that the gulf exists for the very reason that government exercises such a powerful influence in American society, precisely because individuals feel that the last ramparts protecting personal freedoms are about to fail. But I am assuming that the complexities of our society and the sheer demand of our world position will require strong government, led, staffed, and advised by the most competent people we can train and enlist for the purpose. In this case, the ramparts of personal freedom will be better defended by more understanding between the electorate and the elected, not less, by a wider knowledge of the American political process, by a greater willingness to participate in political life and action, and to move back and forth between the private and public sectors of the country as ability and talent permit. It seems to me that the American business community has a special set of responsibilities in broadening the base of political participation in the United States. as the dominant factor in the growth of our economy and the employment of our manpower and capital and national resources, it generates much of our international economic and political strength. It does not and cannot do this in a vacuum isolated from obligations to the public. But the way in which businessmen take part in our public life is as important as the fact of participation itself. Many a businessman has gone to Washington to assume a high federal office only to return home disillusioned and unsettled by the experience. The reason was that he continued to think and react as a businessman instead of a political leader who understood the problems of business. And may I add that labor leaders have fared no better under similar circumstances. Both have remained amateurs in a field where professional talents are required. But the businessman who has a political sense, who understands the responsibilities and the shifting grounds of political leadership, the limitations as well as the opportunities of his job, can make a tremendous contribution to American life. There have been many successes to compensate for the failures. The principal difficulty which prevents a more constructive dialogue between the business community and the elective or appointed officeholder is that they live in such different atmospheres. Certainly the man who runs for office, whether he comes from business or law, is never quite the same after a political campaign, an experience most of us are fortunately not exposed to. The appointed officer, who is at least spared the rigors of campaigning for his position, goes through a cold bath of his own before he settles down in his new job and finds that the range of pressures and interests descending on him are far greater than he ever imagined. But whether elective or appointed, if he has been a businessman, he now begins to appreciate some of the essential differences between his new life and the old, between his new responsibilities and those he has left. These differences exist across a wide spectrum, but they are perhaps most noticeable in areas of responsibility and function that are common to both business leader and office holder. And it's these differences that I want to talk about, because they exist across a wide spectrum and they perhaps are most noticeable in areas of responsibility and function that are common to both business leader and office holder. Both are accountable, if to different constituencies. Both must communicate, if to different audiences. Both must be available, if to different visitors. Both must plan ahead, if in not quite the same context. The business leader is clearly accountable to his board of directors, his stockholders, associates, and employees, and in a broad sense to the public. But compared to the office holder, his accountability is expressed in a more orderly, systematic, and reasonably well-defined way. By and large, if he runs a profitable company, he will satisfy the requirements of his owners and his stockholders. In fact, his ability to turn a profit and run a successful business will compensate for other weaknesses or deficiencies. And granting the heavy pressures and the difficult problems of managing a business organization and of meeting the payroll, there is at least general agreement on the criteria, on the standards by which his performance will be judged from one year to the next. But the office holder, on the other hand, can be and is accountable to hundreds of thousands of constituents, each representing a vast assortment of interests, some of which are much noisier and more articulate in their demands than others. And usually, the more noisier and articulate they are, the less sense they make. Moreover, he can be held accountable several times a day and sometimes far into the night. I know of a prominent Western governor who was awakened at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning by some angry constituents because he had vetoed a bill permitting singing in taverns. And it's amazing what voters can think about and feel deeply about at 3 o'clock in the morning. Some constituents will hold their senator or their congressman accountable for not paying sufficient attention to legislative duties, for spending too much time mending fences back home. Others will take after him for neglecting his district, for failing to keep in touch with his electorate, a point of vulnerability his opponents are quick to exploit. So we have a difference in the area of accountability and the way of discharging it. In the area of communication, the responsibilities are also quite different. The businessman communicates with one body of constituents, the stockholders,
in well-considered financial statements issued at regular and predictable intervals. He exercises control over his communications with his employees and with his customers. He may or may not deal with the press. Certainly, he has an option of making or not making public statements, and when he makes them, he is generally pretty careful about what he says. He will not shoot from the hip if he can possibly avoid it. Even the heads of very large corporations can keep out of the public eye if they choose to, and many do. But the businessman turned cabinet member or governor or congressman or mayor will be called upon to make public statements, to react officially to events many times a day. Indeed, he will have to cultivate the press if he's going to be effective at all, because it's the only way he can develop public support for his policies or program. As a congressman or senator, he's often called repeatedly to answer press queries, whether or not he's had time to consider the problem or whether or not he's had time to think of something else to say. If he happens to be an appointed officer, on the other hand, he may be questioned vigorously by congressional committees, and the give and take of these very wearing sessions may drop an offhand remark which will make front page headlines the next morning. You'll all remember what Charlie Wilson got himself into, the Secretary of Defense of the Eisenhower administration. He didn't say, "What's good for General Motors is good for the country." What he said was, "What's good for the country is good for General Motors." But Charlie Wilson, being the usual outgoing fellow he is, said vice versa. In addition to, "What's good for the country is good for General Motors," and the press reported it the next day in such a way that it produced a shock around the country, which we remember to this day. So you see, the question of communication on the part of an office holder is one that commands and demands immediate and instant reaction to the issue of the day. Last night on television, if you recall, President Kennedy had to answer questions all the way from Cuba and De Gaulle to riots in the District of Columbia, and he had to be aware and knowledgeable about all of them, which is a demand of his job that doesn't come to the businessman in all times. And of all the men in public life, the representative in a legislative body is the most available individual in American society. The executive in business can, at least to a considerable degree, plan his day and even his week or a month. The office holder, especially the man in elective office, often feels that he's rocking along with his time and his plans and his ideas out of control most of the time. He has comparatively little to say about his working day. Interruptions are constant. Senators, representatives, state governors, and mayors have their working schedules constantly broken into by unannounced constituents with nothing more than a casual chat on their mind. And, of course, the most objectionable constituent that I have met is the big contributor who feels he has a lease on your life. I would assume that most constituents believe their Washington representatives are devoting most of their time to legislation, to their committee assignments, and to the work of Congress itself. In reality, they spend half their working hours or more, much more in many cases, on the problems of their constituents. And much of this, as you can realize, stems from the growth of the role of the federal government and the impact, the increasing impact that the government has on our daily lives. For example, one senator has reported that he receives more than 40,000 letters a month on Social Security problems alone. Defense contracts have become increasingly significant in the economies of many states, California in particular. The individual congressman or senator must do his best to see that his state or district is not overlooked. And if he neglects this activity, his constituents will remind him quickly and sharply of it. So this volume of so-called casework, if you will, his inability to control his time, the demands that take him away from the lawmaking process have been a source of growing concern to many thoughtful and dedicated men in political life. In the words of one prominent senator who said, "I just don't have time to study the bills as I should, and as the people back home think I'm doing. I'm just dealing off the top of the deck all of the time. From this comparison of the businessman with the office holder in these areas of shared responsibility and their different approaches to them, you might possibly conclude that I am about to advocate a program of federal assistance to our newest underprivileged class, our lawmakers and our public servants. I don't think they need it yet. I merely believe that as our representatives must know about the problems of the electorate, so should the electorate become more knowledgeable about the problems of legislation and government administration. And I think we have a long way to go from where we are today. And I suggest, therefore, that one way would be to re-examine many of our prejudices and traditional concepts about American politics and make every effort to discard the caricature for the reality. Strangely enough, the American office holder does not take kindly to being called a crook, especially after he's put in 14 or 16 hours a day working on the problems of his constituents as he sees them. Yet a large proportion of the American electorate believe that you can't be honest and be a politician. Not long ago, a sample of American voters was asked this question. If you had a son, would you like to see him go into politics as a life work when he gets out of school? Of those polled, 68% answered no. 21% answered yes, and 11% had no opinion. Those who opposed a political career for their son said that politics were crooked and unethical, and that the temptations of a political career were too great. But the explanation given by those who said yes, they wanted their sons to go into politics, is even more interesting. They wanted their clean-living and clean-minded sons to turn out the rascals who were in politics now. Over the course of many years in Washington, I met many men in public office with whom I agreed and with whom I disagreed. As far as Congress is concerned, I go along with Jimmy Reston of the New York Times, or Scotty Reston, who knows the workings of Capitol Hill as well as any observer I know. And he says that most congressmen are conscientious and industrious men and women with high ethical standards. And there are those who turn the argument on the American voter and say, and this I believe, that he is getting a better deal than he deserves in terms of the caliber of his representation. However, I think the caliber of our representation can be much improved, and we should work constantly to improve it. But it is better, I think, that we realize this because of two trends working in the voters' favor. The educational level of our representation is rising, and younger people, despite the attitude of their parents, are going into politics. The educational level of Congress, especially the Senate, is the very highest in the country. And while we don't have any documentation at the state level, there are indications that a similar process is going on in our state capitals. I have been advised by men of many years of experience in Sacramento that members of the legislature are not only younger, but of higher caliber and much better qualified for their work than their predecessors. Now, when the office holder talks privately and frankly about his constituents, his most frequent criticism is their lack of knowledge of the legislative system. Voters and special interest groups tend to approach their representatives with a particular proposal or objective in mind. When it emerges at the other end of the system, distorted, pulled out of shape by compromise or amendment, or does not emerge at all, the cry of sellout can be heard across the land. But seldom does anybody ever get what he wants from a legislature or a Congress. And after many years of submitting proposals to Congress, I assure you I speak from experience. And one of the principal reasons for this is that the conscientious legislator must begin to think in terms broader than of that or this or that special interest. And this reaches its peak in Congress, where members are constantly confronted with issues, problems, and legislation of national scope and often deep international implications. It seems to me, therefore, that the time has come when we begin to build a few bridges across this gulf of misunderstanding that separates the elected from the office holder. One advantage that we have is that we are a political nation, that we do admire men who have made substantial contributions in public life, that the leaders who have commanded the greatest esteem and respect throughout our history have been political figures. Our attitude toward politics is very contradictory. It both attracts and repels us. And we might reduce this contradictory attitude to manageable and constructive proportions if we thought of public office at whatever level as a profession as stringent and demanding as any discipline in America. We can't all be experts in the profession of politics any more than we can all be doctors or scientists or managers of large industrial organizations. But we can exercise intelligence in the choice of men and women who enter it. We can adjust our educational system to train people for it, at least more effectively and pointedly than we do today. And I think if we adopt such an approach, what should be the role of American business and industry, for which government and politics has some obvious implications, since government and politics determine the general climate of all commerce in the United States? And I would like to offer this suggestion. In times of national emergency, business and industry have not hesitated to make their best people available for public service. The question might be raised as to whether business and industry might develop a workable public service policy that might operate on a continuing basis, not merely when there is a national crisis. Business and industry might rather think in terms of government and politics as a legitimate, desirable form of experience for qualified levels of management. The day is long past when American business can operate in an atmosphere free of government influence or uninhibited by public policies. It might better coexist with government if it both knew more about the other's business problems, if there were more flexibility in the movement of people and talent between public and private sectors of our national economy. And in government, as in politics, there is nothing that can substitute for on-the-job training. The lawyer, who more than any other professional man gravitates to politics, can return to private practice if he's defeated for elective office or when he leaves a point of office. The young businessman generally does not have that opportunity. If he becomes an office holder, he generally severs his connection with his business organization. When he returns to private life, it must be with another firm, possibly even another type of work. But supposing the young man of business were released for elective or appointive office on a leave of absence basis with some form of assurance that he could return to his business association, not as a lost sheep coming back to the fold, but as a man who could make a better contribution to the success and prosperity of that organization. I believe that we might discover that a year in public service, whether it be at the local, state, or federal level, may be worth 5 years on the job back home. It seems to me that such a program and policy in the American business community might well serve two useful objectives. First, American management would be in a better position to draw more frequently and more usefully on the experience of its own members in the political processes and operations of government as they rejoin their organizations. This, I think, in time would build for better communications between business and government. Secondly, some of the best might stay in politics and make it a career and develop the professional skills required of an office holder. Would this be a gain or a loss to business? I suspect that it would be a gain. For it would not only improve the caliber of our representation, but it would inject into government more men who combine the knowledge and problems of business of our private economy with political talent and political sense. And for those who succeeded in attaining professional stature, public service, I assure you, may prove to be an endlessly fascinating and rewarding thing, although sometimes nerve-wracking. And in saying all this, in saying in effect that one way of putting business into politics and one way of making politics and business more attuned to one another is for businessmen not only to contribute to political campaigns, not only to participate in the selection of political officers, but also to actively participate as appointive or political office or elective office holders so that their knowledge and their experience will be gained by the government. This is rewarding, as I said, nerve-wracking. And it reminds me of the senator who said, "I don't see why anybody would want this job." Don't quote me on that. I'm running for re-election. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mitchell, for a very, very interesting talk. Now, as is our custom, our club president, Dr. Callison, will take over the question and answer period. Dr. Callison.
But Secretary, if you will kindly return to the lectern with me, we'll see what the boys have in store for you today. And I see several questions here that are pointed, and I'm sure we'll all find them interesting. We'll start off with, are we approaching the point where curbs will be imposed on the right to strike and some form of arbitration or administrative trial be substituted?
Well, I must say at first I hope not. In spite of the rash of strikes in the last several months and the effect that these strikes have on the economy, I still personally cling to the concept that if you really and truly believe in free collective bargaining, then you must see that free collective bargaining operates in an atmosphere of freedom from government intervention. I think one of the reasons for the rash of strikes that have recently come upon us is the fact that the government has been too prone and too quick to intervene in strikes and labor disputes. It's much more difficult to say to contesting parties, in furtherance of your concept of the freedom of collective bargaining, you go back and settle this yourself. The government is not going to concern itself unless the national health and safety is involved. It's much more difficult to do that than to rush out and try to settle every little strike that happens in the country. I think that we should get less government intervention rather than more. Because the minute you go down the road of compulsory arbitration, and you had an example of almost compulsory arbitration in the longshore strike in New York, you go down the road, it seems to me, of a socialistic state which has all its disadvantages so far as productivity is concerned. And all you have to do is look at states like nations like New Zealand, democratic states, New Zealand, Australia, where labor disputes are settled by courts, and you find their productivity very low. Why? Because the minute government injects itself into essentially private dispute, it must necessarily and does necessarily begin to decide, whether they like it or not, begin to decide on the side or side with the side of those people that have the most votes. A government is a political instrument, and the politician, no matter how ethical he may want to be and is, instinctively is going to make his decisions in favor of the majority in terms of the issue he has before him. And I don't know any better example than that, if I may get slightly political, than the difference between the way the president handled the steel price raise in terms of marshaling of public opinion and the difference in which the longshore strike and the newspaper strike is being handled. It's inevitable that arbitration, the interjection of government, in the long run is bad, I think. I would much prefer to have the system we have now of freedom, with all its difficulties, with all its drawbacks, and with all of the things that are wrong with it. I would much prefer to have that than a neat, compartmentalized road that whose final end is a wage decision by a third party, namely the government, which is not concerned in all of the problems of the business.
The questions run almost exclusively to labor and labor problems, as you may well imagine, and they take on the complexion of our speaker's very extensive background in that field. I think you may have answered this one, Mr. Secretary, but it is, what is your opinion of the government-dictated terms for settlement of the longshore strike on... the Eastern Seaboard?
Well, I think I have. I might add one thing in addition to saying again that this is really a compulsory arbitration in another form, as all fact-finding boards inevitably turned out to be. But in addition to that, it seems to me that as I read the newspapers, a 37 or 39 cent settlement, there seems to be some difficulty as to, the difference as to the price, violates completely the Council of Economic Guidelines, which I understand to be that wage increases should be in keeping with productivity and should not be more than 3%. Apparently, the question of productivity is not settled in this longshore strike. I think they referred the whole question of automation and the lessening of the number of people required in gangs to a study committee. So that here was not only a decision tantamount to compulsory arbitration, but also, seems to me, a violation of the guidelines set down by the Council of Economic Advisers.
This is one that I'm sure is on the mind of a great many members here, and that is, how do you regard President Kennedy's strong opposition to the steel industry's price increase?
Well, I think the president was ahead of the steel industry because I'm not at all sure from what I read in the papers that the U.S. Steel Company could have maintained the price increase that they set forth in the marketplace. I think the president probably was motivated by an intense desire to prevent what he considered to be the beginnings of another wave of inflation. I perhaps can capsule my feeling this way, that I don't quarrel with the president's objective in this area. I would quarrel with the means he used to achieve it.
Our audience, being essentially a businessman, I'm sure will be listening to this. Do you think political contributions should be limited, and should they be allowed as tax deduction? Please comment.
Uh, Well, let me say this, that a year and a half ago, I would have answered these questions differently. But I will answer them now as a citizen. I do think political contributions should be limited for the reason that if you permit individuals or organizations to, contribute, which is the mildest word I could think of, contribute to a political campaign or political officer, you may be defeating the very democratic concept that you wish to invoke in this country. Should they be allowed as tax deductions? I have any strong opinions on that, but I shouldn't think so. One of the problems I think that we face in this country more and more is the and which you hear much about are the political contribution of organizations such as organized labor to specific candidates specific office holders. Here, you really have no limit because there is no personal limit. But nevertheless, even with that as a fault, I would be averse to permitting unlimited funds to be given by any individual to a political candidate. It distorts, in my opinion, the importance, perhaps, that you should give to political participation on a wider base.
Should we have a Labor Party?
Some people would say you have one now. No, and I don't think we ever will have in this country. I don't think that. I think that both political parties, the major political parties in this country, in spite of the wide spectrums and diversity of opinions, the umbrellas that they provide for all shades of opinion, I think for our kind of an economy and our kind of country, they operate very well. A Labor Party in this country, I don't think would ever get off the ground, and I don't think we will ever have one. I would prefer to think that eventually the man who works for a living, as we all do, most of us, would be able to choose the political philosophy that he would best like to support. We are not a government like Britain, and I don't think that a Labour Party, in spite of the very active political participation of some labor leaders, would ever emerge in the United States, and I hope not.
How can business take more interest under current restrictions not applicable to unions?
I suppose the writer meant more financial interest, which may not be applicable to unions. I don't think anything else that inhibits a businessman from taking an active interest in politics or government at local, state, and federal levels. The only restriction that applies to business that may not apply to labor is free use of organization money for the support of political candidates. I think, if I may elaborate a bit, I think that businessmen too often have felt that the pressures of their business and the fact that they, in order to stay alive business-wise, they had to devote all their time and energy to business has left this void in government into which labor has moved, And professional people have moved, lawyers particularly. And what I'm saying and what I've tried to say in my talk was that it is time that business not only became active in voting or contributing money, but really became active in the actual political process of standing for office and taking appointive jobs and so on. And I don't think there's any restriction on that except a company policy.
This one comes close to home. And this gentleman, I want you to comment on the quote, member of the House by the late Clem Miller of the 1st District. I presume he means in regard to Representative Miller being reelected after he was demised.
Well, I have no franchise here in California. I don't even vote. But I would assume that this well might be a reflection on our whole political process or method, and also upon the very thing I'm talking about, the ignorance of the electorate as to what goes on in government. Certainly it is nothing new in America that a man with a name that is well known can get elected to office without having any qualification for that office. That's nothing new. It just happened in Massachusetts. I don't know whether you know this or not, but in 1960, I believe, a man named John F. Kennedy, who was a stock clerk in a warehouse in Boston, was elected state treasurer of the state of Massachusetts. So people are inclined to vote on the basis of a well-known name. And it's merely a reflection, I think, of what I've been trying to say, that the electorate doesn't know what goes on in government and doesn't know really oftentimes what it's voting for.
This takes us back to Washington again, and it is, what can be done about the seniority system as it relates to the influential committees in the Senate and the House? Do you think it is a good method of selection?
Well, I heard President Kennedy comment on that last night in his press conference. He said, as I recall it, that he didn't care to comment on that now. He'd wait till after he wasn't president, because the dangers of commenting on it were obvious. There is no question but what the seniority system inhibits legislation. It permits, for example, persons from, shall I say, safe districts on either side of the aisle, either Republican or Democratic, retaining office and by virtue of seniority becoming chairman of powerful committees without sometimes really measuring up to the qualifications necessary for that job. Although the seniority system has produced in both parties some remarkably able men. I think that President Eisenhower's proposal, which was that of possibly putting a limitation on the term of office of a United States senator or U.S. representative, would tend to take care of this problem, if indeed there is a problem. Seniority systems in government, just as seniority systems in industry, have their advantages and their disadvantages. It often inhibits the good man from rising and keeps the mediocre man in positions of power in government and in industry in positions where he doesn't belong.
We're getting down to the end of our time period, and so, former Secretary Mitchell, when you have answered this question, the meeting will stand adjourned. with our thanks to you, and we're very happy to say that you're now a businessman in the city by the Golden Gate, and we hope that you'll stay here. The question is, my 18-year-old daughter wants to be the first lady president. What is the future for women in politics?
Well, I think women have a good future in anything they undertake.
This is Stuart Richardson Ward, and across the microphone from me sits former United States Secretary of Labor, James P. Mitchell, now the Vice President for Industrial and Public Relations for Crown Zellerbach Corporation. Mr. Mitchell's topic was In Defense of Politics. Mr. Mitchell, you started in by saying early in your talk that when a businessman got into the machinery of American politics, he found that that politics functioned with an almost monumental imprecision and referred to the lack of precision and neatness. Exactly what you have in mind, sir?
I meant that the office holder, whether he's elected to office or whether he's appointed to office, particularly if he comes from business, comes to office with some preconceived ideas as to relationship between people, as to how he shall grapple with issues, and as to what the problems of the particular function he's performing must be. What he finds in public office is that nothing goes according to rule or precedent or rote, that he is often called upon to express opinions that on matters which he may not be too familiar with, but he nevertheless must have an opinion. He is often called upon to grapple with legislation or problems in which he is not expert. He is often called upon to be responsible for and accountable for actions which he has no control over whatsoever. And he is responsible as a politician to thousands and thousands of people, all with varying points of view as to what he should or should not do with regard to a particular issue.
Well, now in talking to the Commonwealth Club of California audience just now in the Sheraton Palace Hotel, Mr. Mitchell, you suggested that the complexities of our society required a strong government and the most competent people, which, of course, we both know goes back to the principles of our founding fathers who established our democracy. What do you see in the way of an educational setup that could provide these men that you recognize that we need, sir?
Well, I think that I would like to expand a little on strong government. I believe that we need strong government at the local level, at the state level, and the federal level. I deplore the tendency of recent years to centralize too much of our governmental power at the federal level. I think that it is important to the business community of this country that we not only have a strong, competent federal government, but that we also have strong, competent people in our cities, in our city government, and at in our state governments. Now, I propose to the Commonwealth Club of California, which consists mainly of business men from industry and business, that the whole business sector of our economy might participate more often and to a greater degree in public affairs than they do now. And that one way of doing this would be for the business community to adopt as a matter of company policy the policy of granting leaves of absence to some of their people to encourage them to take political office or political appointment at various levels, state, county, or municipal or federal. And in so doing, in granting them leave of absence, to assure them that when their term of office had expired, that they would have a job so that they would not be concerned about losing whatever the advantage there might be to affiliation with a particular company. This is a process which is quite common in labor organizations. Professional men who leave their professions like lawyers and accept public office have a practice usually to come back to. The businessman needs some assurance that he be protected if he takes public office. In addition to this, I said to the Commonwealth Club of California that It seemed to me that such experience in government would be invaluable to business when their men who are on leave for governmental service return to business, because they would bring with them a knowledge of how government operates, what the problems are. And in this day and age, business, as indeed everybody else in America, is affected by governmental action every time they turn around in terms of their own personal affairs.
Discussing this matter of the attitude of business and the attitude of politics, I was reminded of what the late Cardinal Newman said at one time: "He who touches politics touches pitch." Did you feel there was some angle of that that impressed you in your study of this field, sir?
No, I was not aware of Cardinal Newman's quotation, but I would not agree with it. I think the concept of the American politician, or I would prefer the word office holder, the concept that is held by many people that an office holder is per se unethical and crooked, is entirely wrong. The vast majority of men whom I have met in public office were honest men, dedicated to the welfare of the electorate which they served. You might disagree with them as to their positions, but by and large, they are no better, no worse than the general run of people. They're all human beings. Politicians and office holders are men who, I believe, need to have a competency that is not recognized generally by the electorate. If we are going to have good government, strong government, then we must recognize that the men who are elected to office or appointed to office must need to be professionally qualified. And by professionally qualified, I mean they must know something about the problems of that office, the problems of taxation, urban renewal, transportation, social welfare, all of the things that government affects. Legislators and office holders ought to know about. So therefore, we need competent people, qualified people, and indeed, it seems to me that in this day and age, the office holder of today must necessarily be a professionally qualified man, qualified to do the job that he's elected to.
And now, former United States Secretary of Labor James P. Mitchell, and now Vice President for Industrial and Public Relations at Crown Zellerbach Corporation, may I try another quotation? A former speaker to the Commonwealth Club of California and a formerly quarterly chairman on this rostrum, the late George Creel, once said that the reason you don't get better men into politics is because they prefer to take their mud baths at Lick Spring. Would you like to comment on that quotation, sir?
Well, of course, George Creel, whom I remember from his writings, is a man whose memory we hold dear. But certainly, the man who goes into politics or stands for office or is even appointed to office must toughen his hide. That's one of the, requisites of the office. He must enter the office with a pretty tough hide and be insensitive, if he's going to do his job, to the inevitable mudslinging that takes place. But the fact that mud is slung, if that's good English, does not detract from the basic thesis that I have, that you've got to have good men in office, even though people may sling mud at them.
May I try one more quotation on you, Mr. Mitchell?
Sure.
And this is from the late Ray Lyman Wilbur at the time when Dr. William Wallace Campbell, for a long time the head of the observatory up here in Mount Hamilton, became president of UC. He said, "William Wallace Campbell is going to be in close touch with things lot hotter than any of the planets that he's been looking at through his telescopes." Do you find that in political life a businessman perhaps has a reflection of that experience, sir?
Yes, he's dealing with volatile subjects and dynamic subjects, and oftentimes substantive items and matters that affect people deeply. So therefore, it becomes hot. And I would agree with Dr. Wilbur in that respect.
We learned somewhere in the Old Testament, I think it was Solomon supposed to have written, "Oh, that mine enemy had written a book." Does that apply in political life in the way of making statements and interviews to a politician?
Oh, yes. So this is one of the points I made in the talks of the Commonwealth Club of California, that the office holder is called upon to make statements to the press and in public on the spur of the moment and instantly, and oftentimes he is confounded by those statements in a way that he had never expected.
And do the constituents have a sort of a crossfire on a man in political office, Mr. Mitchell?
Oh, yes. When you look at the average district in this country, or even take the state of California, you have people who have special interest in the farming and ranching area. You have people who have special interest in the business industrial area, in labor, in the arts, in the sciences, in welfare. And each of them expects the representative who represents them to be particularly familiar with his pet specialty and to pursue his pet project to the ends of the earth, regardless of what else he may have to do.
You made it very clear today, Mr. Mitchell, in talking to the Commonwealth Club of California, that the kind of a job that a man has when he goes to Congress as a congressman, a senator, is one thing, and what actually the job is like is quite another. You gave a grand description of it. Would you repeat that first?
Well, we send a man to Congress, and we elect him a U.S. senator, I believe, under the feeling that he is there to see to it that laws in the interest of the welfare of the United States are passed, and that he is there to study the legislation and to vote intelligently on the legislation when it comes on the floor of his house. However, because of the fact that the federal government today enters our lives in so many areas, congressmen and senators are constantly being asked to do specific and special chores for their constituents. For example, one senator reported that in the course of 1 week he had some 40,000 letters asking specific questions about Social Security. This kind of messenger boy work, while it's important to the individual constituent, oftentimes prevents the legislator from really tending to the basic business for which he went to Washington, which was to legislate.
I thought one quotation you gave was a very good one in summarizing this point you just made, Mr. Mitchell. This senator who said that in handling the bills, which he didn't have time to study, I'm just dealing off the top of the deck all the time.
This is true of many of them, yes.
And what would you say as to the general attitude of a congressman or senator as to whether or not he would like to have his son follow in his footsteps to the Congress, sir?
Well, I believe that most congressmen or senators who recognize the contribution that they make and can make to the public welfare would like to see their sons and daughters follow in political life, even though they recognize how difficult it is. However, the average person, there was a poll taken not so long ago which indicated that the average citizen views politics with alarm. That this poll, as I remember, indicated that over 50% of the people polled indicated showed that they did not want their sons to go into politics because they felt it was not an ethical profession and that many politicians were crooked. This, of course, is a fallacious point of view and is one which I think we should endeavor to correct.
And now, former Secretary of Labor James P. Mitchell, we come to the most important part of your talk, which was, of course, what to do about the situation as you very ably have aligned it to us.
Well, I suggested to the California Club of California, which, as I said, consists of largely of businessmen, that one of the contributions...
Well, may I interrupt you to say that there's a whale of a lot of lawyers, engineers, dentists, educators, college professors belong to the club. You'd be surprised how many we have.
Is that so? Well,
yeah,
we're kind of
a cross-section.
I didn't realize that. I thought they were all businessmen. I'm glad to be informed. I felt that, in addressing myself to the businessmen in your audience...
Yes.
I felt that business could make a contribution to the political scene by seeing to it that some of the executives of business who were so disposed and qualified might undertake a term as office holders in active government work, so that they would bring to government a recognition of business problems, and they would bring to business when they returned an understanding of the political processes and a better understanding of how our government operates.
Thank you very much, former Secretary of Labor James P. Mitchell, Vice President for Industrial and Public Relations of Crown Zellerbeck Corporation. And may I announce that now, the same station, same time, next week, I'll be interviewing for you. The Commonwealth Club of California speaker at that time will be Dr. Norbert N. Einstein, economist, radio commentator, and lecturer in international affairs. His topic, the State Department, competent or incompetent?